Welcome to the Faith Element podcast for June 13, 2021, focusing on 1 Samuel 15:34 through 16:13. Moving on. I'm Crystal Shepherd.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
And I'm David Adams.
Well, we are back and we are continuing the party this week. Partially. Because it is Nikki's birthday.
Yay,
happy birthday, Nikki.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not going to sing because you don't want to hear me sing.
That's okay.
But we celebrate you today. So we are grateful for your birth and for your presence here.
It's a good day.
Yes. So moving to a question now, because, you know, I have to ask a question like David does every time.
That's right.
It doesn't really have anything to do with celebrating, but it's a valid question nonetheless. So when in your life have you reached the place where you had to give up on something you had been holding on to?
Okay, so, and this is mild confession time. It's going to sound kind of silly, but it really is very true. When I was younger, when I was a teenager, I really did have this dream of becoming a model. I really thought that I was going to, you know, walk the runway and pose for portfolios and all of that. And I spent a lot of time working on that. I got connected to an agency. I did a contact commercial. That was a lot of fun. And then I went to one of those things where, you know, they catch you at the mall. This was a long time ago, but they catch you at the mall and they say, you pay this money, you come to this event, and you're going to be in front of all of these agencies. And my mom thought that I had this dream long enough that she let me go. And so we took this big trip up to Atlanta. We lived in a small town in Georgia. We took this big trip to Atlanta. We stayed in a Hyatt. It was amazing. And you had to go and walk in front of all of these agencies. And you went to these classes on being a model. And you learned what the life was going to be like. And I just had all these big dreams. And then at the end of the weekend, I didn't get picked. No agency chose me. And I had to face reality that while in a small town, I could do some things, that's as far as it was going to go. And it was, again, it was, you know, I was probably 17 when that happened. And it was a really important lesson for me that sometimes the things that we want just aren't going to happen. And I really had to sort some things out with my young little mind over that. So that was something that I really did have to figure out how to let go of that kind of a dream.
Mine is somewhat similar to yours, Nikki, but somewhat similar. I was not dreaming of being a model.
You could totally be a model, Bert.
I say what you're modeling. But
well, yeah. That's that catwalk, but I'm too sexy for that. But
indeed.
My high school years were totally about marching band. I mean, that's what kept me going. That's what I lived for. Mm-hmm. That's why I endured sitting in classes all day and did homework at night so I could at least be in band. And I was really good friends with the drum majors each year, and they were all a year or two ahead of me in graduating. And then I was, you know, my end of my junior year came, and I was looking at my senior year, and it just seemed like I should be drum major. And I felt like I was, you know, I just kind of had that, it's my thing. And a couple of other people who were friends of mine in the band were trying out for it, and I tried out for it. We all went to drum major camp together. It's been a week doing all this stuff, that the other. And I just thought, I'm doing this. I'm killing it. This is great. And I got back and the band director gave it to the other guy and it crushed me. And I thought, I deserve this. He says, we need you on trombone and you really are good with what you're doing. And you were good at drum major, but he was a little bit better and we need him to be our drum major. And I was like, okay, you know, and as that year went on, as that fall football semester and competition schedule went on, I realized I wouldn't have changed it for the world. Because I was, you know, I was sitting first chair trombone, and I was band president and captain, and all this stuff, and it was just and he was a great drum major. He really did a great job, and I was so happy for him, and it worked out really well. But man, yeah, I was crushed for a little while. It didn't work out the way I wanted it.
Oh, it's hard, right?
Yeah,
that's so.
But
hard.
Like you said, it was a lesson, and
that's right.
And I wouldn't have changed it any other way.
Yes, yeah, same for me. Same for me. Wouldn't change it.
Well, mine is, I mean, there's been several times I gave up on acting. That was kind of one thing, but not in a more like, kind of like humorous kind of way. I held on to eating gluten forever, even though I knew that I was celiac and I knew that it made me feel bad. And so I hit like a wall, and I was in a meeting, and a friend, we would have these potluck kind of things. It was mothers of preschoolers meeting, and we would have all this food that everybody would bring in. And I had like slapped all sorts of gluten on my plate. And, I was feeling miserable even eating it. And my friend came over, and she has celiac too. And so she had already been gluten free, and she looked at me and she's like, "How are you?" And I'm like, "Honestly, I'm not feeling good." And she snatched my plate off that table, and she walked over, and I watched her just like rake off everything that had gluten in it into the trash. And she brought my plate back to me, and I started crying. And she's like, "We need to go in the hallway." And so we went in the hallway, and we had like literally a come to Jesus, you know, meeting about not eating gluten. And honestly, like, I can honestly say, like, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Mm. Not the best thing that ever happened to me, but, you know, really it's up there because it gave me my health back. But I held on to that gluten for a long time. I like my baked goods. Yeah. So.
Well, I didn't have a moment I can point out when I gave mine up. But when I was in college, I was going to be a musician. I wasn't going to do what I'm doing now. I played piano 3 hours a day. I wrote lots of music. I sang all the time. I did all this stuff, committed to the craft. I was pretty good at it. But now I look and I have two arthritic thumbs. The keyboard playing just ain't quite as easy as it used to be. No. I live in the Ohio Valley, and my allergies and stuff are terrible. And so stuff's running. And now my voice sounds like sandpaper. And it's really hard to hit the notes that I could hit before. Yeah. It's like, well, okay, for a while there, you're singing like Freddie Mercury, and now you're sort of singing like, oh, a cat that somebody got. This one coming in. I can hit the notes, but now it's kind of like you got to struggle for everything. Gradually, that dream faded away as I found myself doing a lot of other things. But it was exciting at the time. Of course, looking back now, I realize I don't sound much better back then when I hear myself than maybe listening to Brian McLaren's album that he made back when he was in college. If you've ever heard that, you'll know just how tragic it can be. But it was a dream. It just eventually just died and faded away.
I have to say, I feel like I know all of you so much better now. This was great. Who came up with this question? It was a good question.
I think David Adams did.
It was me.
Good job,
I
David
gave that up,
Adams.
Too.
That was a great question.
I ended up asking those kinds of questions, too.
It was a good question.
Well, thank you all for sharing. And I agree with Nikki. I do feel like I know you guys better. today's passage has a little something to do with giving up on something that you were holding on to. So, David, can you help us get started?
Sure. And I've already warned you, the singing's gone. So I was going to sing this part. I'll just go ahead and read it to you. But welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. The rest of the line is, so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. But before I talk about the scriptures today, I need to provide you with a little context, even though I can only think of one person currently in the podcast with me who can truly appreciate it.
Woo-hoo.
To be fair, that's because I'm an old person with phonographic memory for old music that many people no longer remember. The 1970s were a watershed decade for music and culture. I could go into painfully excessive detail about all the cool things that happened back then, but in the interest of brevity, I'll just stop at admitting that most of my heart music came from that time. I loved the great soul music of the era, with Songs in a Key of Life and All in All being among my favorite albums. I delved deeply into all that progressive rock had to offer. I collected every piece of music that Queen and the members ever recorded. I know the words to almost every Led Zeppelin song. There's just so much music to talk about that I could rock and roll all night and party every day. On a larger scale, the 70s were a time when most musicians were still required to play an instrument to be worthy of the name. If you could escape that vile scourge upon the earth known as disco, you could easily uncover a culture that reveled in something called arena rock. Beyond the glorious mullets, arena rock was a culturally dominant form of music marked by macho men with hairy chests and incongruously high voices, screaming out anthems and demonstrating their studied misogyny. in many cases while carefully masking their true sexual identity. If you were a 70s rocker, you knew that all the big bands had an anthem of sorts that had to be sung at every single concert. You didn't see Skinner without hearing Freebird. Queen always had to sing We Are the Champions. REO Speedwagon was always riding the storm out. Aerosmith was required to dream on. It's been a long time since Led Zeppelin rock and rolled, but the Eagles always took it easy. At least the Who won't get fooled again. Seriously, all these guys, and they're pretty much all guys, did their signature song at every show. It was like the law of the jungle, and no one was breaking the law. You don't know what it's like. It's enough to make you paranoid. But as a 70s rocker, I sometimes look back at those days with a bit of dismay. It seems like, no matter how big the arena acts got, a lot of the real money and attention went to wimpy little acts that seemed sappy and self-indulgent and whiny. For every immigrant song that later appeared in a Marvel movie, there were 20 or more songs about breakups and heartaches written for people who somehow made it through the rain while waiting for Mandy down at the Copacabana. A lot of people were winding up being all by themselves, or about that time Billy decided to be a hero during the last game of the season on the night Chicago died. It's like the music industry was trying to balance out all this overblown, toxic masculinity with pastel-wearing crybabies. I can't dwell on this too long. Or a little while from now, if I'm not feeling any less sour, I promise myself to treat myself and visit a nearby tower and, dadgummit, there it goes again. Anyhow, when I think of the story of 1 Samuel 8, this kind of thing comes to mind. At this point in history, the Hebrew people were a loose confederation of tribes that had settled in the Palestinian wilderness. They were constantly at war with their neighbors and each other. The only thing they had that seemed to hold them together was a shared faith in God. Occasionally, God would raise up a warlord, they called them judges to be polite, who would unify some tribes and deal with the various threats. But it never seemed to stick. And as each judge passed from the scene, the coalition fell apart and the people got into trouble again. They finally hit on the idea of having a dynastic king, chosen by the religious leaders, of course, to bring them together on a more permanent basis, only to find that the first guy they chose, Saul, had problems with following God's instructions. Determined to fix this mistake, Samuel, or Shmuel, goes to the house of the powerful Jesse to choose a son to make into the king to replace Saul. When he got there, it was the 70s all over again. Jesse trotted out one son after another, all who had the huge macho thing going on that was assumed to qualify someone to be a warrior king. Despite this fabulous display of obvious kingworthiness, God told Samuel that God and people didn't see things the same way, and instead took a hard pass on the kinds of guys who were the arena fillers of that day. Instead, he settled on the good-looking, wimpy songwriting type with the pretty eyes. Yes, the scripture said he had pretty eyes. God had apparently had enough of the bluster and noise of the macho men and decided to go a different way with the choice of king, choosing instead someone who was famous for struggling with icky things like personal feelings. We might be at a similar moment. When we look at the state of Christianity today, it seems pretty obvious who God supposedly prefers. We have no end of loud macho screamers competing with each other to see who can be more misogynistic and tolerant while they compare congregational sizes to see whose is bigger. If the media needs someone to step up and say they speak for God, they seem to default to these guys every time. Never mind the people they leave out. Never mind the ways they might twist the gospel into a vehicle for power rather than redemption. Never mind that those congregations seem to be struggling to hang on to people as more and more leave the faith in search of something more authentic. We're at a critical time where our society needs people of faith to step forward, bring us together, and help us find our way into the future God would have for us all. We're desperate for a faith that brings people in and includes them, rather than tossing them out because they aren't what we expected to find when that feast started. So it's time we moved on. It's time we started accepting all the varied perspectives that create a richer tapestry of faith and stop looking to recreate things we thought worked for us in the past. It might not fill us with the same passion-fueled sense of power that those old songs used to, but God was likely not listening to that kind of music anyway. God doesn't see things the way we do. God's ready to move on and take us somewhere new and special. Do we have the courage to go?
Well, David, as a 70s rocker, I've never thought about this story like God choosing, oh, I don't know, Carole King over Ted Nugent. But this is a new way to think about it. I'm impressed. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's okay, that's the rock and roll equivalent to this. Yeah. But there was something real here because, again, if you're with us last week, you know, we talked about what you're going to get when you get a king. And we said, oh, we want one anyway. We want a king. Well, what they have in mind is this big, huge, hairy, barbarian-looking guy with an axe, probably. It's going to chase away all the bad guys and put them in charge of the kingdom again. What they got was, yeah, first they had the big, hairy, dumb person who could not do what God wanted, refused to do what God wanted, and was just not a good king. So they had to go another way. They had to think of something different. And so what they come back to is what may work for a time. That is somebody who was referred to as a man after God's own heart. You know, someone who made the feelings and made art and made really following God the fundamental basis of his view of kingship. Now, he stumbled along the way because, you know, you get all that power, you're going to do that. But at least he started from a place where he was sensitive to what people really needed as opposed to what they said they wanted.
Yeah, and that's fascinating when you point that out because my friend, the Rabbi Seth Oppenheimer, a friend of ours on the podcast, always says what set David apart from Saul and then from his own son Solomon was that in spite of his horrific behavior, which was horrific from time to time, mm-hmm. that he genuinely saw his role as king as doing what is best for the kingdom, of mm-hmm. doing what is best for all the people, rather than being concerned about himself, which is what typically kings do.
And I think also part of what made David to be such a revered king was that he did point people to that. And even when he went down a road that he shouldn't have gone down, he always returned to God. He did not worship other gods as his son Solomon allowed into under his reign. But he always went back to God. And that is what made David probably the favored king of Israel.
And we asked about this last week. I raised this question, is that how do we get people to want the right things? I think David stands as an example of someone who wanted the right things. Mm-hmm. He wasn't good at it. He often did the wrong thing. But he wanted the right thing. And a good example of this, he was capable of feeling shame when he messed up. Mm-hmm. I mean, nowadays it seems like you show up a politician, you point your finger and say, you've done wrong here. They're going to say, so what? They're going to find a way out of it. Nathan shows up to tell David what he's done wrong. He repents. Mm-hmm. You know, he hears God's voice and realizes he's done wrong. Instead of saying, get out of here, you old man, I don't need you anymore. He repents. He comes back and tries to find his way back mm-hmm. to a closer relationship with God. He was capable of wanting the right things.
I think it's interesting, David, what you talked about as far as there is this kind of shift. They had Saul as a king, and Saul was big and manly and strong, and he carried kind of all of this power just in the way that he looked and carried himself. And David was very different from that. And I think it's interesting that you talked about that there was this, that God pushed them toward, this isn't how you said it, but what I picked up is that God pushed them toward this David as being the king, which was in stark contrast to Saul. And I think you even alluded to that is, some of that is happening in our own time, that this is incredibly relevant. So I'm just curious what connections you make to our own time and how leadership ideals might be shifting, or maybe we are in need of something different right now in the Christian, in our Christian communities of faith, very similar to what they needed in this time, something different and in contrast to Saul.
Yeah, I'm trying not to sound too schooly, but we have reached a place in our society, I think, where we are dealing with a great deal of uncertainty. Even the moral and philosophical ground we stand on seems very uncertain. And we don't know what's going on, and we struggle with that. And when that happens, people get afraid, and they get desperate, and they try things. We look at the things that we might decry from week to week, that, oh, this is bad. Why is this going on in the church? Why do we have leaders like this? Why do we have countries like this? And we realize that these people may not in themselves be so bad, so much as symptoms of a larger badness. I usually refer to it as a sinfulness has crept in. You know, our sinfulness has gotten a hold of us to where we can't escape it. And so we're desperate and we grab for things. And typically, I'll trust our sociologists to back me up on this. Typically in history, when you're in that situation, you look for something that's big and strong because that's going to make you comforting. You're going to be comforted by that. I have a big, strong person here that's going to talk loudly and is going to threaten people and bluster and things like this. And that's going to help us find some comfort because we know they're carrying the weight for us. Mm-hmm. And over time, we often find out that those people couldn't carry the weight for us. They were just all bluster. It was all loudness. What we need was people who are sensitive to everybody else, who thought, again, to unify us and bring us together rather than just wield a big stick and break everything apart. But that's not what we're asking for. We still want the big people, the big sticks. And yes, I was alluding to this earlier about churches. In religious groups too, we want those loud people who will put themselves in front of the camera and say, this is what God says we're supposed to do. Whether they have ever talked to God or not, we want them to be there because, again, that gives a force, a powerful force that'll be there. So we don't have to think for ourselves. We don't have to feel for ourselves. We don't have to deal with it ourselves. That force has this, and it's not our fault if something goes wrong, because after all, it's just that big person in front of the camera. The idea of a big person as opposed to a normal person like us who is with us. And if you really want to back it up, you can also talk about that's what made Jesus so special to us as a religious leader, because Jesus worked with us, walked with us, was there with us, called us his friends, did all those things that brought us together at a common person-to-person level, even taught the two big commandments of loving God with all you have and loving your neighbor as yourself. Jesus, that's how Jesus worked. He could have come down and been the big guy and been control of things. In fact, his time in the wilderness, he was tempted to do that. But he rejected that perspective and said it's about bringing them together.
So David mentioned 70s music as heart music and soul music. Now, I learned about this music from my parents, who had me in the 70s. Sorry, guys. and my high school journalism teacher, Mr. Williford. In journalism class, I first heard Led Zeppelin. Immigrant Song is one of my faves because, let's be real, it has some great rock and roll screaming. And I think that if we listen to the words of it, it might be the kick the church needs. So listen to the words of Led Zeppelin. On we sweep with threshing oar. Our only goal will be the western shore. So now you'd better stop and build all your ruins, for peace and trust can win the day despite all you're losing. May we have the courage as the church to clean our house and reach the western shore. May we rebuild the ruins of the church by wanting the right things and become the open and inclusive community that professes to follow Jesus Christ. As a result, peace, trust, and love will rule our hearts and our lives. Thank you all for this good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about our Faith Element Bible study curriculum at faithelement.net. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.